Okay, and so we enter into the next stage of our reporting continuity and change adventure, with, of course, the backdrop of lady lifeguards being trained in an American newsreel of the 1930s. And don't they look in top physical form, gentlemen? Obviously, there are a whole range of elements that come across in terms of newsreels, some of which we've already started talking about in seminars and will do in seminars following this particular sequence, not least of which is the perspective through which the newsreel is presented to us and the kind of images and the kind of approaches that are given when we're looking at what we see represented in the newsreel. And the topics that were covered in newsreels were wide-ranging and addressed a whole variety of aspects, as we'll see in terms of the sequence. But much as I can tell, we'd love to see the end of this. I have to say, check it up at your own time, and you'll see whether she lives or dies from that point of view. Because I do want to actually move on to this sequence here, which obviously refers to the newsreel itself and the sign of British Pathé, the cockerel that was in so many ways symbolic and emblematic of a whole new launch of newsreels in the cinema, together with British Movie Tone News and others, including, of course, the trip to the Picture Palace, the trip to the cinema, one of the key experiences of the vast bulk of the 20th century, and arguably still into the 21st century. So one of the most important developments of the 20th century, as far as journalism was concerned, was probably the growth of recreation and leisure. Having more time to effectively fill, and also having disposable income with which to actually partake in events which enabled you to make use of your leisure time and so on. As society became transformed by the growth of urban centres, and we've already seen the industrialisation occurring in Victorian times to the present day, the media was striving to keep up. It needed to remain commercial. If the media wasn't selling newspapers, products, clearly it would not be sustaining, it would not be self-sustaining. And this also led to a need for journalists to tap into people's natural needs for information and recreation. We looked last week at the growth of the magazine market, and we saw how the magazines provided one source of entertainment and one way in which people could actually find out about specialist sports or activities they were interested in and so on. This was another area. And clearly the relationship between movie magazines and the cinema is one that is echoed today in magazines such as Total Film, Sight and Sound, Empire, and many more. Sport, of course, as well, a key crossover in terms of where people were spending their time, what they were occupying themselves doing. But of all of the expanding leisure activities which we see developed in the 20th century, one of the most successful was going to be the cinema. As the cinema grew in popularity, so journalists looked for ways in which they could create a presence. Clearly, more and more people are going to the cinema, so therefore there's potential for people to want to find out more about their movies, stars, and so on. This was the same as was occurring in radio broadcasting. If you recall, 2 weeks ago, we talked about how radio could popularise sports by focusing on them, by actually looking at the ways in which those characters and those sports people were being represented in the media. I noted today that we're hearing a campaign for Andy Murray to be recognised as the greatest ever sportsman, and that nominations have already closed for the Sports Personality of the Year because it's going to be awarded to a chap who has no personality. Sorry, Andy, only kidding, never mind. So what I want to do today as well is to focus on the newsreel, which, like radio broadcasts, also had a mass audience, which is fairly critical in terms of going to the movies, etc. It was estimated by the time of the First World War, in 1917, over half of the population would go to the cinema at least once a week. Why did they go to the cinema once a week? Well, it was a cheap night out. The quality of the experience, of course, could vary. depending on what movie you're going to see, and so on. 100 years ago in 1916, as well as being right in the middle of the Battle of the Somme, the number one American box office draw would have been D.W. Griffith's Birth of the Nation, which again was sort of open to all sorts of accusations of popularising the Ku Klux Klan and others, the history of sort of America, the post-Civil War America, etc. Silent movies, obviously, sounds didn't emerge until the late 1920s, early 1930s, but nevertheless universal in terms of the form. These moving images, these magical images, which you would see represented for us on the screen in a major picture house that was defined very much as a picture palace. Many early cinemas, however, were little more than glorified parish halls. Films were actually shown to the troops in France, and newsreel and propaganda films were very common by 1918. So by the end of the Great War and the First World War, it was a fairly regular thing to, as we've seen in seminars and as you can see online with BritishPathé.com, to see documentation of troops either in the battle, in the middle of the Battle of the Somme, post-Battle of the Somme, and so on and so forth. Being silent meant that the makers of the newsreels could also include their own structure and narrative. And actually putting in images, putting in captions, would also change the overall meaning of the actual items that we were seeing. In other words, the early newsreels of 100 years ago were more like illustrated newspapers as opposed to film, as we kind of recognise film today as having its own language and so on. When the propaganda services in Britain were overhauled to create what became the Ministry of Information in 1918, it had actually established both a news division and a cinema division. And the ministry, as far as the government was concerned, aimed to harness the cinema for propaganda purposes. So it drew heavily in its early recruitment on war reporters. Again, we'd gone through the Great War where an awful lot of the war poets, people like Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon, Rupert Brooke, they'd raised in a whole range of ways their own feelings, anti-war material, the futility of war and so on. Here was an opportunity to effectively say, okay, how do we actually develop the notion of, you know, war, how is it being reported, what's happening and so on. And there are turbulent times occurring here. Immediately in the aftermath of the First World War, of course, we have the Soviet Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the execution of the Tsar and Tsarina. Lots of change is occurring. And clearly lots of opportunities for news features and news reels to be developed in addition to what we're seeing in terms of the standard print-based media. And there are a number of full-length silent documentaries, such as the Battle series, which actually would show major engagements on the Western Front. Again, you can access these online and indeed in digital format. Most of those single documentaries, though, and most of those documentaries featuring the war and battle images, were tidied up for public consumption. You didn't have any of the shocking images that would later emerge from the Vietnam War in the 1960s, when it's often argued by American generals that it was the images that were being portrayed on a night-by-night basis to American television viewers that effectively lost the war in America, and also led latterly in the Gulf War 1 and 2 to the concept of embedding journalists to ensure that actually the news was controlled, that you actually check on what is actually allowed out, not only for purposes of propaganda and or morale, but also in terms of what is being seen by the home living audience. But let's return briefly to that sort of period around about 100 years ago in terms of what the Ministry of Film, the Ministry of Information, was looking to actually do. Well, it was more concerned with ridiculing the Germans, as you'd expect, and also showing British successes. The Ministry also carried the responsibility for providing the British public with news about the war. In addition, it would make a number of anti-German cartoons and other films which would promote war savings or ways in which ordinary people could help to boost the economy. Again, these things were echoed in the Second World War as well, saving rubber, campaigns to actually sort of switch the lights off, blackout lights, and so on and so forth. And propaganda trailers were distributed through commercial newsreel networks, like the Big Five that we've put up there, Gaumont British, Movietone, Pathé, Paramount and Universal, the latter two obviously being American in input and output, etc. And as a result of that, they would reach massive audiences. Between the wars, between 1918 and 1939, the quality of the experience of going to the cinema was less like going to a church hall, a bit like this, but became much more glossy and glamorous in terms of how the experience was relayed to the customer. There was also massive innovation, sound, technicolor, and so on. Sound itself emerged primarily in 1930. It was pretty much complete by 1932. Some of the early challenges of sound meant that if the microphone was placed here, anything that was actually said over here would be inaudible. So you often have in some of the early movies with sound actors being very static and actually sort of looking at basically items such as vases, bowls of flowers, etc., which had the microphone in, until they actually started using and changing the way in which you could move and also feed the sound in so it would synchronise with the film and so on. But in addition to that, you also have the use of music. Now, it's probably wrong to say that silent films were ever completely silent, because they weren't. You had a situation whereby in most cinemas by the 1920s, you would have either a small orchestra or at least an organist and a pianist. You'd have some musical accompaniment going along with the images that were on screen. That's often recreated on an annual basis at the London Film Festival, where they'll have a silent film given a kind of fully refreshed accompaniment, whether it's Metropolis by Fritz Lang, whether it's Napoleon, whether it's Battleship Potemkin, and so on and so forth. There are a range of sort of areas that you can see within that. But using music, also using stock footage, inserting material which hadn't actually been filmed as part of the story, would all actually add to the experience of the narrative, how things were developing, and so on. And this whole notion, as you can see there by the foyer of the Westgate Cinema in Newcastle in 1932, was all part of that regular movie-going experience. You'd also, in terms of the cinematic treats themselves, see a far more entertaining montage of images that would be flowing over the audience, and you'd have lots of pace, lots of aspects. As we've seen with respect to newsreels, usually none of them lasted longer in terms of their topic than 3 minutes. They were relatively short, they were snappy, they were dynamic. They were the YouTube videos of their day. By 1939, there were 5,000 cinemas in Britain. Some of the new purpose-built super cinemas could actually seat up to 4,000 people. And around 20 million tickets were being sold each week. How could they afford that, you might well ask? Well, actually, by the 1930s, the average price of a cinema ticket was sixpence, which was roughly the price of a pint of beer. So you again have something which is relatively affordable in terms of going to the movies, going to, you know, see the cinema in whichever city you found yourself. In fact, a survey of Liverpool in 1937 found that 40% of people in Liverpool went to the cinema once a week, and another 25% actually went twice a week. So a large number of people would choose to go to the movies as part of their average way of entertainment, and also a way of actually consuming news. Now, admittedly, this is one of the issues with respect to the newsreel. Did they go to the cinema for the newsreel, or did they go for the feature film, which might be starring the latest Clark Gable, Carol Lombard, It Happened One Night, Jimmy Stewart, Dorothy, the Wizard of Oz, Judy Garland, etc. Lots of sort of areas within that. Actually, I think if we're being honest, most people would go to see the movie rather than the actual newsreel. But again, we'll talk more about that as the piece proceeds. In York, a survey actually discovered that half the population went to the cinema each week, which worked out at around about 45,000 people who would actually regularly go to the cinema on a weekly basis. What does this actually say for us? Well, quite simply, it means that cinema is big business. Proprietors actually wanted to get as many people in as possible. And they would also introduce things like special penny picture matinees. They would have Saturday morning sequences. They would develop a variety of other strategies to make sure that the punters not only came once, but came again and again and again. They'd have lots of gimmicks that would actually work through in terms of, you know, motor cars, stars, all ways in which they can attract people to that whole notion of the cinematic experience. Now, this is long before television. The only alternative entertainment they've actually got in the domestic environment, apart from books, reading and newspapers, is the radio. So you've obviously got the musical, you've got variety, you've got musical theatre, but the cinema is offering something a bit more special, a bit more glamorous, in terms of the line that's working through that. The average typical programme would be somewhere between 2.5 to 3 hours. Okay? You would have an A movie or an A-list movie, which might be about an hour and a half or so. You would have a B movie, which might be about 45 minutes or 50 minutes, kind of the length of an average long TV show these days. Then you would have a newsreel, and then you'd have a trailer for next week, and the newsreel would probably last about 10 minutes. And as I say, sometimes these would be on continuous performances, so you could go in halfway through one sequence and stick around until you actually sort of reach that stage in the next sequence as well. There were, as I've mentioned, five companies that distributed newsreels: Gaumont British, Movietone, Pathé, Paramount and Universal. Each year, they produced around about 520 newsreels. Okay, so not huge numbers, but again, that's quite significant in terms of what was actually being screened on the newsreels and how those newsreels were being consumed by the public. There would be some weekend special edition newsreels, and the makers of these newsreels saw themselves primarily as producing newspapers via the medium of film. It's a really significant part. You could argue it's early multimedia, it's early mojo, mobile journalism, but it is very much a case of producing newspapers via the medium of film. There are about 2 million feet of newsreels in the British archives. And the big question, as we ask you to consider, should you choose to actually elect to do the question on the value, historical value of newsreels, is how worthwhile were these? Now, rather similar to those folk who actually seen the newsreels so far, newsreel reports, they actually are more about communication. They're more about lifestyles, they're more about events. They're probably not necessarily anything other than snapshots of particular times in history, constructed snapshots. But what they do actually tell us is what the public, who might be sitting in the Lyric Cinema there in its auditorium and its large screen environment, were actually being formed about events. Folk may not be purchasing newspapers, but they can certainly afford the price of a pint of beer to go and actually find out what is in the news by checking out the newsreel in the local cinema. It may not be immediate, it may not be up to date, but it'd be covering events that are kind of within the sort of last couple of months or thereabouts. Might be the FA Cup final, it might be the range of sort of royal materials, it might simply be, you know, a range of other sort of quirky stories that are within that whole system. Nevertheless, as you can see from a fairly cursory look at some of the newsreels that we have archived for us by British Pathé, etc., there was a lot of dumbing down of events. Yes, you have a narrative which is very much seen, some might say, as somewhat patronising, some might say as very much a kind of voice of Britishness and so on, received pronunciation, King's English and so on, Queen's English latterly. But those dumbing down of events were primarily designed to make them palatable to the consumer. The newsreel makers themselves felt very much that morale boosting was part of their role. It was important to be cheerful, particularly in times of depression, in times of war, in times of upset and upheaval. It was important to convey the British stiff upper lip to ensure that, well, actually, it doesn't matter. You know, there might be all sorts of challenges going on out there, but fundamentally, we've still got a whole range of things, and you can see there, if you can see it at the end of the war, you're going to see the monster maker queuing round the block. The original term, actually, that gave rise to the term blockbuster, because in America, when people would queue around the block, It meant you actually had a major success on your hands. It was a really popular movie. Hence the term blockbuster movie that's applied to everything from Jaws, Star Wars to Harry Potter and so on, in terms of how successful these things actually are. As far as the newsreels were concerned, it's quite clear that even during the war, British people would actually pull through. And a hearty, upbeat tone permeates the newsreels of the period. And arguably for the 30 or 40 years that newsreels really were in existence and worked through before they conceivably migrated to television and other areas. Inevitably, this upbeat, hearty, everything's going to be okay approach attracted criticism from other filmmakers. Filmmakers who actually felt that the British public should be allowed to see what was really happening. They should actually make up their own minds about images that they were being presented with and should actually not necessarily be force-fed what they should be thinking. Whether that actually dealt with relations between the genders, between the races, or indeed something as simple and basic as how news stories were being developed and valued. Those news values, those ways in which things were evolved and developed. Without a feel-good factor that would constantly creep into the content and the commentary was the key thing to the criticism of filmmakers and the documentarians, who, as I'll show you next week, had a completely different approach in terms of what they would define as reality and celebrating reality and so on. So let's go back to that question as to who is actually watching the newsreel. As we already said, by 1939, over half of the British population would be attending the cinema on a once-a-week basis. And they would be using the cinema as a news source. Where did that half a population come from? Well, maybe it's a north-south divide, because the highest proportion of cinemas were based in the industrial north. You could argue that the majority of the programming was also aimed at the working class. Lower income groups would go most often to the cinema. And the upper income groups in society were not regulars. They would go, but they wouldn't go on a weekly basis. It would be seen as something that might be, you know, maybe once a quarter or so on. They might go to the theatre. They might have other ways of spending their time and occupying their time. Ultimately, the managers of the cinemas, of which there were, as we say, many, they wanted entertainment. They didn't want to upset their patrons. The last thing you actually want is an unsatisfied customer. A customer who's actually paid the money for their ticket price and is so annoyed that they say, I'm going to leave the whole sequence. I have not enjoyed that experience whatsoever. He's a large mini employers of large mini cultures, you know, from the notion of having an intermission, a break to get your ice cream, your popcorn, concession stands, all of these aspects. You don't want to upset the customers. The result of actually taking that as a philosophy meant that you actually had a self-censoring industry. It even got to the stage whereby any music that was in the background of music of newsreels wasn't designed to offend anybody. So you had to have a selection in terms of what was chosen, even going down to the music. In other words, you get a safe editorial solution. Some might argue that actually self-censorship is the most dangerous kind of all censorship, because we never actually see it. We don't know what's ended up on the cutting room floor. We only know that clearly certain things have been selected in terms of what final images we've actually seen. And that safe editorial solution was very much focused on going after the ordinary and avoiding anything sensational. Yes, you could actually have the quirky, you could have the unusual, you could have the bizarre, you could have the surreal, but it wasn't designed to cause offence. Result, the editors of newsreels primarily were a self-censoring collection of individuals. It's probably fair to say that they took their responsibilities very seriously. They had a captive audience. Once you've paid your money and you've stepped in to the Rex Cinema or the Odeon, Oscar Deutsch entertains our nation, or any of the other cinema chains that were actually out there, you kind of were unlikely to leave once you were sort of settled in your seat, ready for the event, and so on. The editors of newsreels also generally accepted that films and movies actually had more impact on audience or on their audiences than newspaper reports. The power of the moving image. The power of the lines. As you can see in this particular advert, we have a range of British Olympic news with some of the kind of areas that have been developed and that sort of might attract people who are interested in, you know, a whole variety of aeronautic displays and so on and so forth. Editors would meet regularly to decide how to handle any subjects that were considered to be a bit touchy, a little bit dodgy. Usually the decision was made not to cover them at all. Now, it's not sure, again, whether or not they had some freedoms, like the press. Again, we've kind of been here before. If you think back to the days of satire and the days of the 19th century and the concerns with respect to that, do you actually cause offence? Do you run the risk of imprisonment? It wasn't necessarily imprisonment. It was just a case of, let's just not cause offence here. Let's develop our own particular take. And there was an uneasy feeling that actually we don't have any legislation to censor newsreels, so let's not attract any unwanted attention that might lead to people saying, this is outrageous. We cannot have another shot of women wearing bathing caps in our fine homes. We need to ban it straight away. Let's work our way through that. Some of you will know what that was about. Others, you'll have to just wait and see. Or maybe not. There was this notion of the average taste of the individual. What do we mean by in good taste? How do we see what is appropriate? What might, as I say, when viewed through the eyes of a scholar in 2016, be seen as sexist, objectifying, racist, and borderline insulting, could be seen as quite charming of the period. Again, you've got to sort of be careful in terms of where issues of taste actually lie. And there was a lot of debate amongst newsreel editors in terms of what do we mean by the average taste and the average person's individual taste. Well, anything to do with politics or the monarchy or indeed religion was treated very, very carefully. When Edward VIII abdicated in 1936, the newsreels didn't report it at all. Why? Because they thought it's a very significant aspect, but it could cause an awful lot of offence and problems, so let's just let's not report it in any way, shape or form. In fact, there was a vast range of stuff that newsreel people actually avoided and chose simply not to cover. Any British men that were seen to have overseas relations with ethnic girls, a definite no-no. Any army officers that were shown in a bad light, absolutely out of the question. Any hunger marchers, the Jarrow Hunger March, for instance, definitely not. And in other words, a whole range of things that, again, lead to that notion of, well, what, you call yourself news? Yeah, what are you focusing on here, etc.? The Spanish Civil War and so on. Actually, this led to the accusation that newsreel producers and editors were cowards because they simply didn't fully report what was going on. Again, as we've noted, this was all partly due to the fear of the introduction of censorship, or again, of offending the audience due to this whole notion of, you know, what is likely to cause offence and so on. How are we seeing this whole sequence? As I said, Odeon, Oscar Deutsch, entertains our nation, in case you wondered what the Odeon actually once stood for. And that is not the recent remake of Dad's Army. That's back in the day of the 1970s. Again, this generally cheerful tone of not offending anybody, becoming self-censoring, having an uncontroversial content, having views which basically became mere statements of fact, had actually served them well through the Second World War. And this was widely seen as actually hitting the right note. Censorship as an actual legislative right may not have extended to newsreels, but every time that they actually showed something that the ordinary man didn't like, such as scenes of war and violence, there was a chorus of protest. So that kind of begs the question, what did the average man or woman actually want to see and hear? Well, the newsreel actually served an audience who effectively wanted to hang on to the decencies of life. They had a belief primarily that their rulers knew what they were doing, that things were generally optimistic, that actually it didn't really matter. You know, ultimately, as long as we kept going. And there was this sort of sense of an esprit de corps, which you can't necessarily say, well, this was just the fault of the newsreels, because it was a reflection of society. We get the newsreels, or indeed the politicians, that we deserve. And that policy of not offending anyone produced a very well-defined and a very strictly policed vision in both the 1930s, in the 1940s, and the 1950s. And if you want to get a snapshot of kind of a cultural theme, certainly within Britain at that time, and arguably America and other countries as well, look at the kind of newsreels that are being presented. Look at the representation of what we're seeing. How particular characters are being portrayed. Again, it's a wonderful snapshot on a reality. We don't have this opportunity to look at sort of other sort of eras that we've sort of considered. We do in the last century. 20th century, probably the most documented 100 years that there has ever actually been in terms of breadth and range and quantity of images that come through on that basis. Possibly eclipsed by the 21st century, but we're only 16 years into it, so too soon to tell. Social and political systems weren't attacked, as we've said. The nation, Britain, was assumed to be strong and fair. The Commonwealth was secure. And the class system, really important, upper-class people don't really associate with middle-class people, they don't really associate with working-class people, was actually assumed to be fairly natural and also quite good. You know, why should we worry about class consciousness? It's served us well all these years, and at the end of the day, you know, ultimately, our leaders should know what's right. It's doing the right thing, once again. Other viewpoints that might have challenged that would be simply excluded. Again, to us, when we listen to the newsreel commentary, the reports can sound patronising. They can often be ill-informed. And they're often delivered in a clipped form of received English. It's not so much received pronunciation as Oxford English or BBC English. This would be the voice of news reporting. And indirectly, many people have also said this has led to the decline for a considerable period in regional dialects, in actually having that one kind of voice. There is a move, and there has been over the last 5 to 10 years, of shifting back to get more dialect in terms of the news, to actually not worry too much about the accent and so on. In fact, I think most of you were in the session that Sam Perdue coordinated for Country Fire Chat, Matthew and myself, a week or so ago, where we were talking about the importance of accents and where that can come through. But that's relatively recent. And you've still got kind of flattening out in terms of what you call a neutral voice and so on. And nevertheless, for all the criticisms that one can make about newsreels, certain newsreels, such as the World War II bombing campaigns and areas which showed some of the after effects of the World War, etc., they actually did have a real selling power. They could also pull in an audience. Again, going back to that financial imperative, that what's the point of having newsreels if the public didn't want them? Clearly, they did, because there were chains of specialist news theatres that also began to reflect the popularity of newsreels. A range of things such as the Tatler New Cinemas. The Times opened up a range of new cinemas as well, whose specific incarnation was just to run newsreels and documentaries. By the beginning of the Second World War in 1939, there were about 50 of those specialist news theatres in towns, or some of which were even attached to hotels. Now again, what's the purpose of that almost cinematic news clubs that you actually develop? It was to start unpicking the news, to begin decoding it. There's a heck of a lot of information that comes through the still image, let alone the moving image. You know, there's a whole range of things there. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, then watching a newsreel is equivalent to reading Karamazov, Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky and Tolstoy's War and Peace. It's huge. But how do you start unpicking that? How do you start decoding the whole thing? And part of the strategy within the news groups was to hold discussion groups which would talk over what the audience had actually seen. People were genuinely worried in the 20s, 30s, 40s and so on about the speed of film. You know, the number of images that work through before you actually sort of, you know, it looks as though it's a continuous sequence, but it's not a series of images flashed one after the other very rapidly, so the eye doesn't actually tell the difference between what the image is being seen and the movement that's actually there. In other words, the story would move too quickly. It wouldn't allow the audience to think and reflect on what they'd seen. It's a totally different structure from reading a story where you can actually go back and pick up at your own pace what things are doing. We don't have a pause button. You need to effectively continue to keep watching it. Once it's started, it will finish. There are also concerns about the authority of the camera. Actually putting a camera, as I'm sure you all have found during J-Skills, can actually be quite a major decision. And deciding what to do in your call sheet, and this is an example of one from 1962, is also quite significant. It starts addressing the sort of notion of A, what are you going to film, how it's going to be positioned, and so on. As you can see in this particular story, where the editor was a certain G.T. Cummins, first lead story is Cranwell, it's the King Hussein with the RAF of Jordan, Haynes movie tone, length, footage, commentator, cutter, editor, etc. And a whole range of things running right the way through to the Trafalgar Square Christmas tree, Father Christmas goes by copter, helicopter, Christmas pudding, eating contest, Deb's ball, automation restaurant, the baby chimp, what's not to love, a hunting we will go, main and end titles, end of. Okay, so the structure is actually there in terms of place. But if you're looking at that, and you're selecting about the notion that does the camera ever lie? Are you suggesting to the viewer that this is all truthful? How can it be truthful if you're using stock footage that might be sourced from a completely different area? Cutaways, we've already talked a bit about this. Adding frowns, adding smiles, adding noddies, all of which reinforce the story and the narrative that you're telling, also have an impact on the veracity and the truthfulness of what's actually being said. Now, in addition to that, you might also expect that in terms of the ownership of newsreels, there were a number of press proprietors who got involved with the newsreel at its height. It's a good money-making opportunity. The owner of the Daily Telegraph, Camrose, held extensive shares in Gaumont British. Lord Rothermere, who was part of the Daily Mail empire, was joint owner of British Movietone News. And Lord Beaverbrook from the Daily Express was connected to British Lion Films. So again, you've got cross-media ownership that's involved with that, likely to again echo the kind of images and the kind of press formats that we see developed as well. It has to be said, though, that even those connections are relatively slight when you compare them to the way that newspaper companies began to acquire large stakes in commercial television from the later 1950s. And that's a key sort of purpose to really rationalise why we don't still have the joy of newsreels today. Why we can't see cameramen's caption sheets for British Paramount News being developed and presented, and how the newsreel actually has existed or changed. And it's primarily due to the television system. As television took over, and it's possible for families to watch the news in their own living rooms, the significance of the newsreel began to fade away. Not all at once, because again, as has been noted, we had the onset of television being very much in black and white until the late 60s, and newsreels would respond by obviously being glorious technicolour in the 1950s. But ultimately, this immediacy and impact of television news coverage would be highlighted by what's often regarded as the first television news war. I mentioned it earlier, the Vietnam War. Vietnam occurred in the mid-1960s, and it's generally regarded as being the first living room war. The first war that the public, whether they were in France, America, Germany, Britain, whatever, could experience through their own television sets in the comfort of their own homes. We'll go on to talk a bit more about war reporting and issues relating to documentary in subsequent weeks, the remaining sort of weeks and packages that we've got here. But it is worth noting that concerns that are existing even now about whether constant exposure to war and disaster over a worldwide basis actually doesn't lead to more caring and concerned audience, but leads rather to apathy and boredom rather than action and a willingness to engage with these concerns, is actually a worthwhile debate and concept to work through. For now, two groups of you have still actually got to see possibly the bathing cap, or you might select something completely different. Thanks for your time, and I'll see you. And don't forget tomorrow, available to actually hand back your, or give you some feedback, shall we say, on your first critique assignments. Thanks for your time. See you then.